your natural mind is silent. Your natural mind is spacious, it's open, it's undefended, it's peaceful. These are just words that point at what it is. I spoke quite a bit last week here. Oh, by the way, anyone who's here for the first time, welcome. Thank you for coming. Thanks for joining us. I spoke quite a bit last week about conditioning, the nature of conditioning, and the inevitability of facing conditioning if you're an honest, authentic person, which some people are not honest and authentic. They actually practice deception, contradiction, manipulation. They live out patterns of greed, hatred, delusion, and they experience the conditioning of those states and the consequences of living in that conditioning. So actually, it's extremely fortunate. It's a great, good thing to recognize the distinction between what it means to engage with life, to engage with your life, if you want to call it that, in a way that's honest, direct, authentic, and inevitably that means facing one's curriculum, I'll call it, or one's conditioning. When we're small and little, even in grade school, oftentimes, even into middle school, we don't recognize conditioning. But when we get a little bit older, sometimes it's shocking to recognize, wow, I'm actually afraid. Some children see this, but wow, I'm actually vulnerable. I'm confused. I'm unsettled. I'm restless. I'm desirous. You know, I want what I don't have, and I don't want what I do have. And variations on this occur. And this is part of the wake-up call. When you begin to come up against karma, you begin to see for yourself what it is, that your actions have consequences, that your thoughts have consequences, whether you act upon your thoughts or not. And you begin to see the possibility of taking responsibility, eventually complete, total responsibility for your situation. Because there isn't any true spiritual awakening unless you take full, complete responsibility. Irregardless of what track you began on, how easy or difficult it was when you were raised or born into your family of origin. Some people don't have a family. They start out in an orphanage. They're foster children. You look at your situation, you go, wow, you know, some things went really well, and maybe some things didn't go so well. It's all part of your curriculum. It's all part of your coming to terms with your situation. There is no spiritual awakening, true spiritual awakening, without psychological, emotional, behavioral integration. Anyone who sits and meditates, even meditates deeply, meditates for years deeply, develops concentration, blissful states of consciousness, degrees of happiness, isn't truly spiritually awake unless they're integrated relationally, integrated psychologically, integrated emotionally. That means being able to be cognizant, present, alive, awake, learning amidst your thoughts, your feelings, and your behavior. And you see the interrelatedness of thoughts, feeling, and behavior. You begin to see where your impulses and your intentions come from. What kind of intentions do you have? What are your true motivations? Another way to put it is, what do you really want? Not what you want superficially, like, I'd like some ice cream tonight. It's a nice little thing sometimes. It makes us happy. Momentarily sensorily happy. But what really do you want? And sometimes we don't know. Sometimes we're confused about this. We don't know what we really want. So I'm prefacing all of this, or predicating all of this, on honesty. And you see that honesty is something that you can practice. You can tell the truth. It's not always easy. It's not always fun. It doesn't always go over well. Depends who you're talking to. Or you can slip and slide a little bit. You can wiggle and wobble. You cannot sit straight in your situation. You know, by the way, sitting and learning to sit, learning to relax into sitting still, is taking responsibility for your situation to some extent. I'm not saying force stillness. I'm saying learning to relax into stillness. You're not going to have a still mind unless you can have a still body. Why do you think yogis practice yoga for asanas? Yeah, anybody know asana, the word asana? Posture, yoga postures? Okay, why do you think yogis practice asanas for 25, 30 years before they even start meditating, really? Because in certain yogic traditions, you're not even prepared to begin to meditate until your body is prepared to sit still. If your diet's imbalanced, if your behavior is imbalanced, if you're living in degrees of reactivity, pushing and pulling with things, you're not going to be able to sit very still. Everything has consequences. Everything has effects. Causes have effects, and those effects create new causes. It's a chain of dependent origination. This isn't all that life is, it's part of what life is. It's the part of life we can talk about some. There's parts of life we can't talk about. It's beyond comprehension. Like if I just said, what is infinity? What does boundlessness mean? What is enlightenment? We can't talk about these things very well because there aren't words for these things. They're beyond description. Who are you? Really, this is beyond description, it's beyond concept. And I'm suggesting that one can't be, in a way, ripened or prepared or ready to see into those subtleties of the mystery of life, that which is beyond description, unless you've sorted your curriculum, taken responsibility for your conditioning. If your father was mean and it hurt you, if your father was withdrawing, if your mother was emotionally rigid, unavailable, tired, confused, and it affected you, and you begin to recognize this in your psychology. You feel it in your gut. You sit quietly and you remember what it was like, or you sit with a therapist and you talk about it, you open it up. It's what human beings do at this time, in this culture, and in other cultures too, to come to terms with their situation. What you begin to see is the difference between concepts and reality. And I'll put my hands like that to say one is here and one is here. Concepts are right up here. It's what you're thinking. It's what you're believing about anything. And then there's reality. Reality is closer to what you sense. It's closer to what you feel. It's closer to what you intuit. It's closer to what you call instinctual. For example, an instinct, very simple instinct. You get your hand on the hot stove. It's already burned a little bit. A little bit. You feel the sensation, boom, your hand pops off. Try to keep your hand there. It's extremely difficult. There's an instinct that your hand pulls back. But remember, we've all experienced this. It's too late. You already got burned. Nobody gets their hand off the stove instinctually fast enough to keep that burn from happening. Now, you can have a very small burn if you're on your game. You know what I'm talking about? Okay, you've all experienced this, right? Okay, that's just one example of instinct and how it works. It's not intuition. That's why there's two different words. Instinct is one thing, intuition is another. Intuition has to do with sensing, realizing what is true, but not necessarily knowing how you know it. Just one way to describe it. Remember, this is all description. These are just words. It's not the word that's important, it's what the word points to. So the word is a concept, and the word can point to experience in a way that's useful. What happens when the word points to experience in a way that connects or is resonant or useful is that this stops being so central. You start to experience the reality, so to speak, a bit more of what is right now. So this curriculum or this conditioning has within it thoughts and beliefs. It has memories. It has patterns. It has tendencies. It has habits. And it also is a story. It's the story of you as you believe yourself to be. It's the story of life as you believe it to be. It's not what life really is. It's your story about life. It's an abstraction. Now, some people have a very interesting story, like a good writer, let's call it a fictional writer for the moment, can write sometimes a very intriguing and interesting story that's completely and utterly made up. Or parts of it are things that actually happened, and then they add the, you know, imagination and the fancy twist, and you come out with a good story. And you can't even tell the difference sometimes. Like, that seems like something that could happen. Well, maybe that didn't. I don't know about that. It's like movies are like that sometimes, too. It's like, well, they're interviewing Matt Damon, you know, the guy who plays Jason Bourne. And in the latest movie, he has a car crash where he wipes out 170 cars. 170 cars. Now, that is really hard to do, you know. I think it's kind of impossible. You know, like somewhere along about 10 maybe, it's going to stop. But 170 go flying out of the way. Okay, this is a movie. It's make-believe. Your thoughts, if you believe in your thoughts too much, you're believing in make-believe. And so what begins to happen as you wake up from the trance of your story and your conditioning that gives rise to that story, is you begin to not only feel life more deeply, sense life more deeply, with all of its nuances, but this story, this conceptual overlay, starts to be less important. It starts to be less central. And what starts to be more central are things like what your heart, the language of your heart, which is not really words. Although I would add that sometimes the heart seems to speak right up into the brain. Actually, what I'm talking about now is the difference between living up here and then enacting this into this. And this beginning to work its way up into this so that you look into people's eyes and you see their heart in their eyes. You hear their heart in their voice. Pay attention to a very, very skilled singer. Could be male, female, could be a child. I love watching really skilled singers in the form of children singing, because the innocence and the purity, not just the beauty of the sound, but to the look on their face, the look in their eyes, the innocence, the openness. It's not a story, although you can make a story about that. It's underneath, it's prior to the story. And that's in all of us. Whether it gets a chance to wake up and come out, that's another story. So does this circumstance of your potential, the possibilities in your life, need to be left to chance, luck, good fortune, win the lotto, spiritually? Absolutely not. Some of it is that. Some of it is tied into what in particularly Hindu spirituality is called fate or destiny. There's some people who are going to wake up more completely in this life than others. Some human beings are going to die in fear, in anger, in unresolution. They won't have resolved their psychology. They won't have resolved their behaviors. They'll be asking for someone who can't make it because all they need to do is say something before they breathe their last. They just got to say this thing that's been in them. And so they're not going to get to say it to that person because that person's not going to make it. That person's not there. So the logical, rational, pragmatic, intuitive, instinctual possibility is exactly what I've been saying. Take full responsibility for your situation. Take full responsibility for your happiness, your sadness, your suffering. If there's a problem, point the finger straight back at that which perceives the problem. There's really a problem out there. There isn't a problem in here. Then this ought to be skillfully able to interact with that problem. I don't care how big or small it is. And the evidence of this is extremely clear. If those who've written books are still interviewable, who've been through something like the Holocaust, and have awakened through that, they have a story to tell that's profound and amazing and integrative and heart-wrenching and liberating. It's no false transcendence. There's a student of meditation who came on a retreat some years ago. And he approached me at the end of the retreat and he said, "I have a book for you I'd like to give you." I said, "I'd love to see that book." He said, "It was written by my mother. My mother went through the Holocaust. I'd like you to have this book." And I said, "I'd like that book very much." And then he went and got it. And when he got the book, he brought it back. And inside the book and the cover, his mother had written something. I can't remember the exact words, but she wrote very few words, but the words expressed directly, immediate, in the heart feeling that I was her friend. Because anyone who was a friend of her son was immediately a friend of hers. But it wasn't cliche. Do you know the difference? That caught my attention. Got to the first page of the book, and within the first paragraph, it was one of those books. Not only do I know I'm going to read this whole book, but I'm going to have a hard time putting this book down. One of those books that, you know, you could get sleepy, but you don't want to fall asleep. You keep reading. And maybe if it really gets going, you stay up all night, and you're okay with that, and go to work the next day or school. It's worth it. She worked her curriculum. She lost her whole family. She came over and over so close to right there you could have died, right there you could have died, right there you could have died, right there again you could have died. Whoa, that was on the edge. And then there were the pictures at the end. She made it to America. Had a family. And that family had families. And then there were these pictures of the weddings. And there was this woman in her 80s, 87, 88, 89. She's beautiful. She's dressed wonderfully. Her hair's in place. She's smiling. She's awake and present and appreciative and integrated. And you'd see it as clearly as I did if you read just a few pages of that book, never mind the whole thing. That's an extreme case. Thank goodness we're not all in such extreme cases. But this extreme case is all over the planet that people are dealing with. Some of them are close to us. Next thing you know, you might be having something go on that seems extreme, that seems acute. Oh my goodness, this isn't acute. This is chronic. There's a chronicity here to something that's going on with me. There's a chronicity to my reaction, to my fear, to my uncertainty, my insecurity, my social anxiety, my addiction, my craving, my confusion. Yes, it's mine. It's mine. It's not somebody else's, it's mine. I both own it and I don't own it. See, I gotta own it in order to come to a place to realize it's not really mine. Because nothing is really mine. And the only way you see what boundlessness is to realize that nothing is yours. And when nothing is yours, then everything is yours. And I'm not talking about you have your name on the title of that. That's not ownership. That's called a make-believe arrangement that we've created. Called, you own the house. We don't even own this. This is just part of who we are. If you believe, and some people do, that this is all of who they are, then automatically with that belief comes the fear of loss of this. Fear of disturbance of this. And the nature of this is transition. The nature of this is experiences, feelings, thoughts, and the body itself arises and passes. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Through the dust of my parents' bodies in the riverbed, and left some for my siblings to also spread because it was in a location that's remote. That was the wishes of the parents. Left some of the ashes in the bins. They mixed together. Mom's ashes, white like the white in this blanket. Dad's ashes, gray like the gray in this blanket. That caught my attention. How come hers are white and his are gray? Does it have to do with carbon? It must be a chemical thing. Thinking. Said to my middle sister the other day, should I spread the rest of the ashes? I'm going to this place, this remote spot, soon, up near Canada. She said, yes, go ahead, spread them. Finish it. Then another message came. She said, actually, I'm changing my plans. I'll be going up myself. Don't spread them just yet. Made me happy. You touch them too, sis. You throw them in the air. Because that's your life right there, just like it's my life, just like it's their life. That's life. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. You say these things, remember hearing these things. They're in the movies, but it's real. It points to the truth of our situation. Ephemeral. Impermanent. Transitory. Part of the curriculum opportunity is to get very, very settled and comfortable amidst change. Someone who says, I don't like change. I like to keep it the same. There. They're going against the law. You can only have so much of that. Right? And life comes right around and says, change that up for you. Just in case you're still listening, I'm in charge, not you. It's the curriculum. It's the law, it's the Dharma, it's the way things are. The great good news, the great promise, the great possibility is that we can become settled and realize that in part we are that law, we are that Dharma, we are that transition, we are that truth. Then you're not so much in the beliefs and thoughts. And the insecurity that cycles around those beliefs and thoughts if they're invested and held on to. Now, even the belief that you are the body exclusively, or you are the mind, I am the thoughts. Just look at opinions, how opinions move between people. Look how upset people get when different opinions are coming forth. It gets violent, it gets aggressive, people die over it. Opinions, cherished belief systems and thoughts, can't take the opposition, I can't take that which seems so different from what I think it's about. So I don't want to hear it, I don't want to even notice that part of the news. Because it bothers me. I'm polarized in my own little pocket of what I think it's all about. The opportunity, yeah, the invitation of the Dharma is, have a look at that. Have a look at that. Doesn't mean you don't care about experience. Doesn't mean you don't have fun. You want to know how to have fun? Really have fun? Don't hold on to anything. Don't hold on to anything. Now that's not possible. Because if I say to you, don't hold on to anything, then you start holding on to not holding on. I know how to do that. No, you don't. I can try. Watch me. You can't overcome clinging with thinking. You can't overcome clinging with a plan. You can't overcome the tendency to attach with some kind of formula. You can't overcome it with drugs. You can't overcome it with sleep. You can't overcome it. You can't beat it. Because that very part that says, I'm going to beat you, is that thing that it's trying to be. The I, the me, the self that says, I'm going to get this one down, is itself clinging. That's why the Buddha was so precise and clear in his teachings. And he said, clinging. Clinging is the root of suffering. And clinging is born from ignorance. And what is this ignorance? It means not seeing the way things really are. The more the insight, the intuition, the clarity about the way things really are arises, born often from some degree of commitment and earnestness, willingness to not run away, hide, but to face, sit, if one's style is to sit. I'm doing a lot of actually Qigong these days. I got this practice that was given to me, and I'm doing it every day. And I did a lot of yoga in my life, like a lot of bending of my back and twisting it, standing on the head, taking, what do you call it, cloths up the nose, down the mouth, and the belly. You know, I figured out how to do all this stuff. Put a little honey on it, take it down the throat. It's insane now that I think about it. I'm not sure what I got out of it, but I did gag. I figured out how to do all that. I didn't go in my ear. Okay, that's a different one. Nose, out the other nose, you know. Like a floss up the nose. You know, it's different than teeth. The yogis did this. Yeah, it's interesting. Huh? Can figure it out. I haven't a clue what it actually did for me. Stop eating meat, pure vegan, fast 3 weeks straight, just water. Interesting. Nothing changes the sense of you except insight. You can floss the sense of you all day long. You're not even going to particularly make it cleaner. Feed it simply and only tofu. Which would be distressing to some people because they say, we've got a problem now that's been delineated here called soy is not okay. But yesterday,
at least over here, it was good. Too much of this, too little of that, you can go nuts. And plus, am I supplemented correctly? Because clearly, the soil doesn't have it in it anymore, as it should. We've messed that up. At least where I live. What about what I'm drinking? I was with some friends in California and had, I can't even think of the name of it, this water purification system that cost $5,000. Oh yes, it took out all the acid. It was like pure alkaline water. And I was like, may I have some? He said, sure. Poured it very sort of carefully. Should we toast or should I just try it? It's like, oh, this is smooth. Yeah, this is nice. And I thought, I need it. I have to look this up. I need it. What's the brand? Then I started researching. It was like brands all over the place. A lot of them coming from Korea. Cool. KKK and Genesis and all the brands of how to take the acid out of your water. And then I got close and I called a friend who does these things himself sometimes to extremes. And I said, has this come into your life yet? And he said, oh yes. I was researching the ones that cost $15,000. And I said, then what happened? He said, I got overwhelmed and gave up. And I thought, yeah, I think I'll go with that. I'm going to go to Sears and buy a new filter for my refrigerator and keep going. I don't have $5,000 anyways to spend on a water filter. I don't know what I was thinking. The belief system, you know. The middle way isn't just a line. It's not even a line, you know. There's a movie called The Razor's Edge. It's also a book. The most recent version of the movie was done in the 80s, and the star was Bill Murray, who I happen to like a lot for a bunch of reasons. And the movie is about waking up, and waking up in the world, not out of the world. And that's what it's about. And it's a well-done movie because it's a good story. It's a little bit like Siddhartha. Different, similar theme. So what compels you? What are you really interested in? Because if you get really interested in anything, and really follow that, really let yourself dig in, it's going to wake you up. It's going to bring your curriculum on board. It's going to bring your conditioning on board. And it's going to bring your potential closer to the surface. Now, what does that look like? When your potential is closer to the surface, you don't stare into the sun, because that's not good for your eyes. But you don't feel as afraid of anything. Your feelings, other people, situations, new situations. When your potential is awakening, you don't feel as afraid. You don't feel as withdrawn. You don't feel as tired. You don't feel as needy. You don't feel as resistant. These are the indicators that which seems to inhibit and impair and even debilitate you lessens. You notice that you don't have to work so hard at being present. Simply being present begins to happen more readily. This means, in part, you're less living in concepts. You're less living in the story and the beliefs.
There was a disciple of the Buddha once who had a tendency, when anything, even the slightest bit of suffering appeared, I mean, just like something happening to the ants on the ground, for example, and he would cry. He would cry profusely. And after some time, he became known as the weeper. You could say, if you interpreted him, that he was completely and utterly sympathetic. But as he learned the Dharma, as he practiced the Dharma, as he received the teachings of awakening, his weeping still happened. The Buddha honored him. He honored him because he had an unusually open heart. The Buddha revered him. That doesn't happen very often. Fully enlightened, fully liberated, fully free, fully emancipated human being. Publicly, openly, directly, honoring another. It usually goes the other way around, doesn't it? You can look it up. Probably find it on Google. The Weeper. Maybe put the Buddha in the Weeper. See what comes up. There's something out there, I imagine. It's probably in Wikipedia somewhere. The Weeper. Some people are busy now trying to record everything, trying to get it all down. Like Google wants to get every book ever written, and being written, and make it available online. It's a project going on now. Those stories, those concepts can be inspirational. But when you begin to see what they point to and what they inspire, that's a sense. That's a feeling. That's an intuition. That's a realization. That's an insight that wakes up. It's not a thought. I'm not saying that some of our potential isn't manifesting through our thought process. It is. But the distinction between concepts and reality, the distinction between the story and what's really going on here, is critical. And it's precisely meditation that helps us make this differentiation. And as this differentiation takes place, lo and behold, we discover that the story, the thoughts, the ideas, the beliefs even the opinions, can be more and more and more influenced by, infused with, what's in our hearts. What's in our true hearts, not our conditioned emotional heart. Because in the conditioned emotional heart, sometimes there's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of trepidation. There's a lot of grief. There's a lot of sadness. I'm talking about the true heart. What is the true heart? The true heart is compassion, kind, generous, forgiving. That's where even the manifestation in current time, organized religion in the form of Christianity, got it right in the teachings of forgiveness. It's very central. It's right there in the Lord's Prayer. I don't think that's by mistake. There are those who recognize that we get hurt and we hurt others, and we need to learn how to forgive. And we need to receive forgiveness.
because we're going to F it up. Unintentionally. And we need a response to that. Because if we don't have a response at that level, we don't have a response in that arena, there's the risk that we're going to go like this to parts of life. We're going to go like this to certain people. They crossed me too many times. You don't have to go close and stick your finger out and get it smacked again. You can forgive them from the other side of the universe. You can receive their forgiveness from the other side of the universe. It is not dependent on physical proximity, and it is not dependent on being in a body. We're in a circumstance where those that are coming in, taking their first breath right now, are significantly outnumbering those that are taking their last breath right now. There's still a lot of space around here, but it is getting more crowded. This is not a permanent situation. This thing we're sitting on is not permanent. It was born and it will dissolve. This world that you say, you know, is a perception about reality. It is part of reality, but the perception about reality is the story. Until that perception is clarified, and then I'd use a different word, I would say realization appears, and tendency to live in the limitations of perception loosens. Not necessarily all at once. Just like fear doesn't tend to go away all at once. It goes away in pieces. That's why this is peace work, P-I-E-C-E. P-E-A-C-E. Am I missing something? Something needs to be added. Adjust it. What are you thinking? What are you feeling? What are you aware of? I'll take the thing and turn it off so you're not recorded.